Welcome to the sixth episode of Sea Control, your moment of PowerPoint recap from the Center for International Maritime Security. This week, we're pleased to be joined by James Zaffer to talk about U.S. Coast Guard training and assistance program, as well as his experience traveling the world. As a quick reminder, you are our best advertiser. So tell a friend about our show, now available on iTunes and Xbox Music. We think it's a very fine product and hope you do too. Now, without further ado, sit back and enjoy the show.
Welcome to another episode of Sea Control, your moment of PowerPoint rehab from the Center for International Maritime Security. This week we go more into, let's call it a story mode. We've spoken to a lot of folks from DALEX and some academics about conceptual strategy and policy. And this week we are joined by Jim Daffer. He's a Coast Guard officer who conducts security cooperation work overseas. And he's going to tell us a little bit about what it's like to be overseas, the kind of work that he's done, what he's seen, what works, what doesn't work, and just give us the ground truth on the kind of stuff that the United States is conducting overseas to increase the capability of our allies. Welcome, Jim.
Hey, Matt. Thanks for having me.
Well, to start off, where have you been? Kind of give a laydown of all the different places you've managed to visit.
Sure. Well, I've been working with the Coast Guard's Mobile Training Branch, which is our International Security Cooperation Security Assistance Unit, for the better part of the last 2 years. In that time, I've done 18 mobile training team missions overseas to 12 countries, and I'll be heading to Singapore Thursday, about 2 weeks from now, thanks to the shutdown coming to an end.
Awesome. Can you give us a laydown of the 12 different countries, if you even remember all of them?
Sure. Well, I've been to every continent now except for Antarctica and Australia. Maybe one day I'll get a pass through there. But when I started this work, I went to Brazil, and then Oman, and Bosnia and Herzegovina, Albania, Sao Tome and Principe, a tiny little island nation off the Gold Coast of Africa. Djibouti and lovely East Africa.
Yeah.
I've been to Tanzania, was my most recent mission, and I've also done a few missions more locally, Dominican Republic, Jamaica, Mexico, and then I've done some work in Southeast Asia, including Indonesia and Malaysia. And like I said, my next mission will be in Singapore.
Now, are all of these for increasing capacity, or would you say, which ones would you say are partnership? Because I see Brazil on there. I see you're talking about Singapore. I would say that some of the countries on this list, maybe Mexico, probably already have a pretty robust, and maybe this is my incorrect interpretation of it, have a very robust maritime capacity for boardings, especially in the case of Mexico due to the narco wars. Are all of these building capacity and training, or some of these partnerships and both parties are learning from one another?
Sure. Well, for our part, we are a very small unit, a very small part of the Coast Guard, and one of the only ones that's doing security cooperation. Most of what we do is funded directly by the Department of Defense for their various funding sources for overseas security assistance. And then a small portion is also funded by Department of State for the same purpose. But they're all for maritime capacity building. When we talk about what we say no kidding capacity building in the Coast Guard, each year our international component tries to target 1 to 3 countries where we might be doing what we call genuine capacity building. Many of the other places will follow the money, who's willing to pay for us to be there, who wants Coast Guard expertise. And we do one of what we call the other missions under the security cooperation umbrella. One of those is access. We want to keep U.S. access to ports, facilities, ship visits, as well as just having U.S. access to their various facilities. We like to do leadership training. We try to give them an angle towards how the United States and our military and police forces do leadership training, leadership development. And, of course, when we talk about leadership development, we usually are starting with the most junior of officers, understanding that it could take between 10 and 15 years for them to be in a mid-grade position to actually enact some sort of change within those organizations with that American tilt that we're hoping to give them. And the other one is simply outreach and relationship building. Unfortunately, the Department of Defense and the Department of State just don't have enough on-hand resources for those security cooperation officers, their political military foreign officer specialists. They just don't have enough people to embed themselves fully in the organizations that are most critical to building maritime capacity. So by bringing in mobile training teams, whether it's us, the Coast Guard, or the Navy, Customs and Border Protection has an international mobile training team, or what we could say MTT element. They're able to get Americans to be with these folks for long periods of time, sometimes as little as 2 and as much as 8 weeks at a time, to do relationship building with these organizations, which could also be to gauge their capacity, to gauge future training opportunities, to target some of their leaders to bring to the United States to do maritime education training here with DOD or Department of Homeland Security or Department of State. So capacity building would probably be about a quarter of the countries we travel to. The rest would be relationship building, access, outreach.
Now, go ahead. No.
Well, just targeting a few countries you mentioned. Mexico does have a substantial capacity. And what we were doing specifically in Mexico was doing training on platforms that had been purchased from the United States, which the Coast Guard uses specifically for the Mexican Search, Rescue, and Dive School, which was built recently in Acapulco, Mexico, and modeled after the Coast Guard's training center right here in Yorktown, where our unit is based out of. So they do have a substantial amount of capacity, but what we were doing with them was more to train them on the search and rescue side than it was for drug interdiction and at sea boardings.
That's interesting. And this is just coming from the Navy side, as that kind of gets beaten into us, but I guess not everybody concentrates on that part. What would you say you in particular have concentrated mostly on? So you say about a quarter of this is actual capacity building. You're a small team. Is this just your small team, or are you just a small part of a small team? As in, you've got multiple units operating at the same time that go from country to country, or are you literally just the A team of American Maritime Security Assistance?
Well, I'd like to say we're the A team. We have a small contingent of primary deployers for the international mobile training side of the Coast Guard. It's about 30 people, and we specialize in different Coast Guard mission areas. Right now, the two primary ones we have are maritime law enforcement at sea boardings, and the other one is small boat operations, which would include basic small boat handling, advanced small boat handling, and to the same extent, some outboard motor maintenance, engineering, logistics, and then to a lesser extent. And this is something we've kind of focused away from in the last couple years. We also do contingency planning, port security, port vulnerability, and courses related to maritime prevention and response scenarios. But what I focused mostly on is small boat operations. That being said, I've done the full gamut of courses that we generally focus on, including law enforcement. But depending on where you go, the focus is different. For instance, I mentioned I went to Brazil. That was my first mobile training team mission, and we were working on behalf of a Department of Defense funding program called HAP, or the Humanitarian Assistance Program, to develop contingency planning skills with our ICS system for the Brazilian military police and the civil police and the bomberos, to try to be able to help them have better interagency cooperation, communication, and connectedness for the major events upcoming there, obviously the World Cup, and then the Olympics. But other countries I've traveled to, for instance, Indonesia, they have a small unit of Sea and Coast Guard, which is within actually their Ministry of Transportation, but splits maritime authority with the Navy. And the country's, one of their objectives is to develop this unit, and so they brought in us, the U.S. Coast Guard, to try to build capacity. And for them, we were working mostly with maritime law enforcement at sea boarding, and also providing the embassy, in this case, the Export Control and Related Border Security Program for the U.S. Embassy, with some advice on how they can build a self-sustaining full-time boarding officer training program with the schoolhouse, as well as all the requisite equipment. So I focused on multiple areas. I've done most of it, but my official role right now, the team that I work with, is for small boat operations. And of those 30 primary deployers, about 12 of them work in that area. And we deploy in teams of between 4 to 5, depending on the mission. And we will rotate those personnel based on their availability, their circumstances. So I don't travel with the same team all the time, but it's usually among the 12 primary people that are part of my team.
What would you say the cultural challenges are, or even let's back up from that a little bit and say, when you go on these missions, what's the scope? How many people are you training? You got 4 to 5 guys. You head out. You're doing small boat operations everywhere from Malaysia to Albania. The difference in the mission, how long are you there? What are you trying? Are you trying to get them to basic skills? Are these guys with basic skills that you're trying to push to another level? And then what have you seen are those cultural differences between that? Because I imagine between Tanzania, Bosnia, and Indonesia, these are all very different places with people with very different perspectives, cultures, on how perhaps they view their mission.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, one of the biggest challenges of doing international security assistance is that a lot of times we can't be on the ground to see exactly what it is that we're going to be working with in terms of the assets, what equipment they have, the people, their ranks, their relative skill levels for the training area until we're actually there. So we have a standard curricula across the board of Coast Guard core competencies that we're trying to transfer. And when we actually get there, a lot of times we have to adjust that based on the skill level of the personnel. Usually, most of the places that we'll travel to, understandably, are underdeveloped places that need basic capacity to use the resources that they have in order to successfully accomplish some sort of mission. And ideally, that mission will support internal defense as well as broader U.S. national security objectives. So, for instance, a lot of places, including East Africa, you have very new organizations, a lot of material that has been donated or purchased from programs like FMS or elsewhere across the Western world. And we're trying to give them the basic skills to be able to use that equipment and operate that equipment and have some measure of risk assessment, safety, while at the same time as a level of mission consciousness so that they can accomplish something. Unfortunately, if you sell someone a boat and they don't know how to operate it, that doesn't do a lot of good for, you know, the embassy donation program, foreign military finance. That doesn't do us a whole lot of good. So normally it's basic skills. That said, occasionally we'll run across locations, and one good example would be Indonesia, where while they lack capacity for sustaining their own training programs, they have a lot of really good equipment. In fact, we were doing a boarding officer course for them, and they had all of their own training equipment from non-guns, plastic guns for
red and blue guns,
practice.
Yeah.
Exactly. They had foam batons. They had full law enforcement belts, training handcuffs. They had everything there. They just didn't have a training program where they could use the equipment themselves, at least to an appreciable level. So we step in and we use all of their equipment, understanding the environment, having done a survey of our training site, and we're able to train them to a higher level because they have most of the equipment there already, which is a great baseline for trying to proliferate some of those skills amongst themselves after we leave. Sir, go ahead.
No, go ahead. I'll let you finish up. Yeah.
Well, your second question had to do with the cultural differences, and there can be a lot of cultural challenges. And if you go to places like Eastern Europe, where the embassy is mostly focused on like non-proliferation of weapons of mass destruction, things of that nature. Sometimes it'll have to do, particularly with Coast Guard core competencies, with, for instance, when I was in Bosnia, the primary thing that we were doing there was trying to train up their maritime border patrol in preparation for Croatia's ascension to the EU, because the only part of Bosnia that accesses the sea is a tiny little town called Neum.
Yeah,
it's like 12 kilometers of total access to the sea. It's not even a major port. It's just a vacation town, but they were having a lot of logistical issues because that border up until Croatia's ascension into the EU and the Schengen provisions was just an open border that didn't even require a passport to go through. Just a form of ID would work. So we were trying to help the U.S., one of their broader goals of trying to develop Bosnia, which is still a kind of an interesting place to work. But right. The cultural differences you see are vast. And one of the most challenging ones I have is, and this is most true in parts of Southeast Asia and the Middle East. I traveled to Oman in December of 2011, is that in U.S. military culture, you always want to have the most experienced person training in that area of expertise. So in the Marines, you may say, and I've heard a Marine Corps naval attaché say this, that you want to have the best rifleman in the platoon teaching everyone how to shoot. Well, in a lot of cultures, you don't have that. What you have is that the highest ranking person, regardless of their experience level, is in charge of training, even if they're not particularly experienced. So if you have a senior person get on board a vessel, if they've never operated that vessel before and are with four people that have, they will sit silent, defer, and will not step in, regardless of whether they're receiving quality training or not. And this is a very common thing we run into, is very strict rank structures. This is also true in Mexico, to some extent, where the very senior people, regardless of their competency, are deferred to in a classroom setting, in an operational setting, in a training environment, which can make training very difficult, because in the United States, obviously, our training culture is a little bit different. The other thing I've found, and this is true in parts of East Africa, is that the way that they're educated, regardless of their level of education, is to be very straightforward. Everything is down to the facts, a lot of memorization. They don't focus a lot on critical thinking skills. And when you're trying to teach someone how to do maintenance of an outboard engine, something as simple as the cooling system, where the water around the engine is going to be moved through that engine and then discharged somewhere else, they don't have the critical thinking skills to be able to follow those systems, and understand that, you know, water has to go somewhere. The liquid has to be moving through that engine. If you were to close the thermostat, which regulates the level of water, it can't just sit there and pile on. That's a concept that is sometimes difficult for them to grasp. And the way that we try to teach in the United States is always to focus on the foundation of critical thinking skills. Not everything has to be laid out directly. And that could be a big challenge as well.
Well, it's interesting that you mentioned that. A lot of people, myself, I'm guilty of it. Guilty, let's not say guilt on it, but complain about that checklist culture and, hey, it's all memorization and don't understand the how or the why. But the idea that maybe we're not the worst at it is heartening. Though, maybe you could speak to this. You were talking about Indonesia, and then you brought up the issue of guys that don't necessarily have the best understanding being in charge of training. In the case of Indonesia, would you say a lot of these countries have that problem where they buy a bunch of gear mainly because people say, well, I'm not sure what I'm doing here, but you know what, I'll make sure that we at least have the right gear? Or is it just similar to that, I have a budget, I'm going to buy as much as I can mentality that a lot of people in the military understand? Like, if I don't spend it today, it'll disappear.
Sure. You do see that. I wouldn't say that that's particularly prevalent. Like I said, most of the underdeveloped places that we travel to for security assistance don't have a lot of resources to begin with. So most of their equipment is very old. In fact, I was just in, like I mentioned, Tanzania. We were working with the Marine Police, and the U.S. Embassy, as well as the Department of Defense, has done a lot of investment in developing that agency. But one thing we found is that they were utilizing some of their older vessels. In fact, one of them was a former Yugoslav naval patrol boat, not for operations, but just as a barracks for the police there. And the only vessels that were really capable of being used were the ones donated recently by the U.S. Embassy. And they were falling into a state of relative disrepair, although still operational. But even if they could keep those vessels in good repair, they don't have the fuel to perform training. So resources is a serious problem virtually everywhere that we travel to. And in fact, whenever we do small boat operations, training on the water, fuel is the primary concern when you're working with that agency. And obviously the embassy will donate it, but those skills are perishable and they're not able to be followed through and retrained and kept current because they just don't have the resources for training. Other countries you find have a substantial amount of money, and this is not an issue. One of the big Coast Guard projects right now and one of my future mobile training team missions is in Saudi Arabia. And the Saudis clearly have no issue with
money, yeah,
with money whatsoever. And there's actually a full-time Coast Guard contingent there, which is developing a new maritime infrastructure security force. And they're able to purchase all the equipment that they possibly want. And in fact, they are purchasing a substantial amount of new boats, new weapons. But what they need is the training. And they just don't have the human capital to do what it is that they want to do, which is have a force that can just be purely focused on maritime security. So we're going to be sending a few teams there, hopefully later in the year, to do some capacity building with those guys. And that's a situation in which they have all the resources they could possibly want. What they really need is the human capital to be able to operate those. And the Coast Guard just has the best model for what our core competencies are to be able to provide those skills.
You know, I won't lie. I ran into a lieutenant commander, Coast Guard guy at the Defense Entrepreneurs Forum. And one of the things that I really liked hearing from him, based on what you said with the Coast Guard model, a small example, PME not being based on rank. It's being based on the ability to be accepted. And I like that training model, the one that says it's based on your capability, not on your rank. So that does speak to that. I do have a question, though, based on, we talked about resources. One cultural question and the second one observational. Would you say that the issue with repair, 3M, PMS, all these other three blank words that we come up in the military to talk about, yep, maintenance, did you say that issue is resources, or is it a different mentality? Because in the military, in the United States here, we look at things, we're about all about maintaining them, and this is a steady state thing, and I'll have the ship forever. Whereas perhaps overseas, they look at it, I buy this thing, I expend it, once I'm done with it, I get a new one. And then the second part of that being, have you seen, so guys don't have a lot of resources, they're still out there trying to do their jobs. Have you seen some innovations out there that you admired, where you said, hey, that's kind of neat that you did that to overcome your resource limitations? And if you have, maybe give us one or two of those.
Sure. Well, when it comes to resource limitations and the idea of 3M and PMS and all the systems that we use in the United States, you don't really find that in many places that I've traveled to overseas. And that includes some of the more developed places, like I mentioned, Brazil and Indonesia to some extent, but definitely not to the extent that we utilize programs like that to maintain our equipment. Most of what I see, and this is particularly in underdeveloped places, is scavenging of parts for older equipment to be used on newer equipment. So like you mentioned, if you run a boat for a very long time without providing the proper maintenance, eventually it'll break, something will break, which even if it's an easy fix, simply renders it unable to be used until that fix occurs. In the case of engines, you might not have dealers who could provide parts within hundreds, if not thousands of miles, depending on the area that you're at, making it very expensive to order and very long lead times. So oftentimes what they'll do is just use those inoperable boats, equipment, whatever it may be, and they'll just scavenge it for parts to provide in the boats that are working. So oftentimes you'll have boats sitting at a pier that haven't been used for a long period of time simply because, you know, the one or two parts they might need to repair them, they have not been able to order, they don't know how to order them, they don't have the money to order them, and they just simply will begin using those boats for other parts. Another thing you will find is if something breaks, they will simply throw it away. I've certainly been places doing outboard engine training where we could open up a locker that's just full of engines, and they really don't have a whole lot of issues. They just stopped working one day, and they were just placed in a big Connex box, and that's where they've been left. There's really no inventory accountability. They're not monitoring the parts. You mentioned the possibility of some of these organizations in developing countries finding to maintain a lot of their equipment. You know, unfortunately, I can't think of a single instance where I found, at least right now off the top of my head, a situation where I thought that some creative measures were taken which would perhaps exceed my expectations. A lot of times the creative measures that they use to spare resources are not particularly the best. And one of the most common ones is mixing fuel with water or kerosene or another cheaper component in order to maximize it, which in the near term works relatively well. However, obviously that causes substantial wear on the engines and equipment. Sometimes they'll use standard motor oils, things like, rather than using the manufacturer's type for a two-stroke or four-stroke engine, we'll use one that they can just pick up out of their local gas station for a substantially lower cost and use that till the engines break. Creativity in terms of maintaining their assets and equipment sometimes might be admirable, even if it's not the best way to go about doing it. But in their case and in a lot of their perspective, these organizations, it's better to have something operating
than,
you know,
not
like cutting your fuel, yeah, than having no fuel at all. Because if the fuel runs out, you know, and you don't get another stipend from the government to purchase fuel for that month, you're simply out of operation. And particularly for Marine forces, one of the big problems that they do have is that a lot of these Marine forces have some sort of land component. And one thing that they'll do is if they have a certain ration of gasoline for a given month, a lot of times they'll fill their trucks and their cars with that gasoline, even if it's something that only serves a function to say as a command car. So you can move the colonel or the admiral or the captain from A to B. They'll fill that truck first and the remainder will go to the boats. And so they won't have the fuel that they need to do training and operations because they prefer to keep the fuel to put in their cars and trucks beforehand.
That sounds kind of linking back to that rank issue where, man, yeah, I could totally patrol my entire area, but unfortunately the colonel needs to drive around in his F-150.
Exactly.
Now, just for the audience, just to give a perspective, I don't think people maybe not understand that when you go out to places like this, I remember in Bahrain. Now, Bahrain's got a massive naval facility, but even there, United States, you'll just Google, hey, where's the local store? Is that it's not as easy here as going onto Amazon and saying, hey, can I find this or can I go down to Home Depot? Now, some that I remember being taught about is visitor programs. Do you guys do anything? You're going out there, you're doing that strategic influence. You're saying, hey, not only am I building your capacity, but I'm trying to get to know you. I'm trying to build access, trying to build trust. Like, I forget who said it, you can't surge trust. And that's what you guys are out there building right now for the future. Do you have any programs or as part of your wheelhouse, what you do, bringing some of these guys back to the United States, showing them what we do here? Or is that just another department or program that the Coast Guard runs that maybe you could speak to?
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. Like I mentioned, I work for the Mobile Training Branch, but we're part of a larger division within the Coast Guard's training system called the International Division, which takes its marching orders from the Coast Guard's International Affairs Department up in Washington, D.C. Another very large part of security cooperation is what's called, and you may have heard of it, but it's called IMET, International Maritime Education and Training, or International Military, Education and Training. Get stuck on that maritime sometimes. But that's a program that is highly successful. It's got about $100 million a year, and we use that to bring our military counterparts from overseas here to the United States for training and education with various DOD, like I mentioned, DHS, and to a lesser extent, DOS schools. And we do participate in that. We have a very successful program called IMOC, or the International Maritime Officers Course, which is actually located at Training Center Yorktown for the Coast Guard. And every year we bring in students, maritime officers from about 50 countries, and that's part of the 130 total countries that the IMET program seeks to touch every year. And they come here for approximately 4 months to do training, learn how the U.S. does leadership training. They go visit the various military academies. They do a tour of the East Coast. They visit naval ships. They visit media stations. They take courses in media relations, risk communication, operations, maritime law enforcement, the full gamut of programs. So that's one aspect. When it comes to delegation visits, this past year, we hosted 7 delegation visits, at least to my host command at the training center, for things specific to how to develop full-time training programs and facilities. One from Malaysia, where I actually reunited with some of the command members of the training staff that I was associated with, including their commandant of their maritime unit. We've also had a delegation from Uruguay who was looking to provide training specifically to Haiti. So they were trying to develop overseas capacity building expertise specifically for a delegation that they're hosting in Haiti. That as well as others who will come through just to see how Training Center Yorktown serves as a model for maritime training. And one interesting thing to note is that most of the world doesn't have a maritime force tantamount to our U.S. Navy, power projection, overseas naval warfare. Most of them have a single, relatively small, if not under-resourced, understaffed maritime unit that could be called a Navy. It could be called a Coast Guard. It could be called a maritime police unit, a maritime police Coast Guard, whatever your name for it, they essentially serve the same functions, which in addition to their defense function also serves a police function, a law enforcement function, treaty enforcement, border security, patrolling of their exclusive economic zone. So that's usually the ones that we end up dealing with, those smaller countries that need those Coast Guard competencies more than they need, you know, what you might find for the U.S. Navy. But we do host visitors. We do participate in IMET. So there is a large umbrella of international security cooperation programs that the Coast Guard contributes to. Naturally, we're a smaller component of that. Primarily, IMET is Department of Defense, just like we see cadets and midshipmen at our military academies. So
one of the points that you brought up, you talked about countries having maritime security component, not necessarily Navy, not necessarily Coast Guard. Maybe let's speak to the difference then between the Navy and the Coast Guard. I'm sure most of our listeners vaguely know that. But speak to sort of posse comitatus, the whole concept. Yeah, I'm going to bring that out.
Sure.
The difference between conceptually what the Navy does, and of course a lot of it's mixed now because with the United States Navy doing counter-piracy, now we're getting sort of into that law enforcement, but it's international law and different. But baseline, at home, the difference between what you can do, what you do regularly, and what the United States Navy does. And I'll correct you if you get
sure.
Say all I do is sit on big gray hulls and do nothing all day.
Well, I'm not gonna try to speak to really what the Navy does. I can contrast some major differences. Well, I mean, Matt, you know, I talk to you and sometimes I don't know half the acronyms you're using, so I'm not going to.
That's fine. We brought that burden on ourselves.
I would say the primary thing to recognize is that the Coast Guard is one of the five armed forces. It's a maritime service. It's military, but it's also a multi-mission. So while one of our 11 statutory missions is defense readiness, as you know, and as many of my Navy friends are very eager to point out, in times of war, including World War I and World War II, the Coast Guard actually transferred entirely under the control of the Department of the Navy, and we served as a smaller subsidiary, taking our marching orders directly from the U.S. Navy. So in times of war, that is our primary role, to serve as a naval component wholly within the Navy. But in times of peace, and really ever since World War II, our primary missions include search and rescue, stewardship of environmental resources, environmental protection, pollution response, contingency planning for disasters such as Hurricane Katrina, the Deepwater Horizon oil spill. We do a lot of port security, port vulnerability assessment. We protect our ports. And ever since 9/11, just like most federal agencies, we took on a substantially enlarged role in counterterrorism, primarily domestic counterterrorism in our ports. We established a number of specialized units, including a maritime safety and security team in most major ports, and a maritime security response team, which was supposed to be our and currently serves as our primary tactical component for maritime counterterrorism. But going back to your point, posse comitatus, essentially what you're referring to there is the Coast Guard's law enforcement mission, which is a substantial portion of what we do. We do a primary federal agency for maritime law enforcement. And what you're specifically referring to is the Post-Civil War Act, which essentially bars the U.S. military from doing domestic law enforcement. Well, the Coast Guard is exempted from that statute. And that's one of the primary reasons why we don't serve in the Department of Defense. We served in the Department of Transportation up until 2003 when we moved over to the Department of Homeland Security. When it comes to the relationship between the Coast Guard and the Navy, and particularly with that law enforcement authority, one of the things we're often fond of saying is we have these teams called TACLETs, or Tactical Law Enforcement Teams, also known as LEADETs, Law Enforcement Attachments, which deploy with the Navy. And given that the Navy is not supposed to be conducting domestic law enforcement missions, if they do take on that role, we say that the Lieutenant JG in charge of the 14, 15-person LEADET will raise the Coast Guard flag on top of the naval vessel and in some regards take control of the authority of that vessel and deputize it as a Coast Guard ship for the purposes of doing maritime law enforcement. Now, not serving in that particular community, I can't speak to how true that is, but we do deploy on Navy ships to do domestic maritime law enforcement. But, you know, to get back to your main point, the major difference between the Navy and the Coast Guard is, you know, we have a substantial number of domestic missions, maritime prevention, pollution response, which another big one is aids to navigation, buoy tending.
Mm-hmm.
What's your missions that the Navy doesn't have anything to do?
Yeah, I think people often forget about that part, too, because I mean, that's a huge part of the rules of the road is buoy tenders, who's allowed to be screwing around in the channel, and you're like, who's that guy? And you're like, all right, he's Coast Guard, he's allowed to do whatever he wants.
A little guy.
Now, back to the U.S. side training missions, when we have visitors, when we send them to their assorted officers' courses and leadership courses. Sure. Do you meet a lot of those guys out there? Do they come to you and say, hey, I was part of this program. It's really cool to have you guys here. Do you see that return? I know it's a small program, a small program relative to, of course, the training programs we have for our own military. But do you meet a lot of those guys out there? Do you see that churn on it where they come back, they want to engage with us, they want to do more training, and they're sort of getting more into the mode that we're trying to help them build?
No, absolutely. Particularly for our IMOC students and graduates, I can recall at least a couple of occasions when I've run into them in the field. And like I said, you know, relationship building is a big part of what we do. One major example is that the United States helped recently establish a Coast Guard in Djibouti, which is more for littoral defense and counter-piracy as part of the greater mission of the recently established Counter-Piracy Council, which includes countries out there. And the commandant of the recently established Djiboutian Coast Guard is actually an IMOC graduate. So he worked with the U.S. Coast Guard during our program and has since elevated to that position. But others I've interacted with, we've had graduates from Croatia who I visited overseas and who I've kept in touch with. And, you know, that relationship component's big. In fact, one of the things that we try to identify when we're overseas is students, military professionals, officers, and enlisted that have the English capabilities and the drive and the talent to be able to come to the United States. Because while we try to focus on leadership programs, when it comes to building that capacity, particularly with countries of great interest to the Coast Guard, a big example would be Mexico and Jamaica. We identify enlisted members to come and do our basic rating courses, or what we call A school, where those enlisted members will come and go through the same exact training program that Coast Guard members will to gain their rating specialty, whether it's, you know, bosun's mate or machinery technician or one of the various ones. We don't have quite as many as the Navy. I think you guys are up to, what, 70 some ratings?
Yeah, no, I know exactly what you're talking about. There's like a huge pile of ratings out there. I still feel like every once in a while I'm running into a new one that I've never seen.
I'll tell you, a few years ago when I was on a ship, I went to a damage control firefighting school up where you were previously stationed at Mayport, Naval Station Mayport. And the person who was teaching a portion of the course, it was probably half a ship. A small Coast Guard cutter, only a 70-person crew, is in the class. And I don't recall what it was, but we did not recognize the three-letter rating of what this person's job was. And so we all sat there for about 10 minutes just trying to guess and eventually asked him. And we found out his rating, and perhaps you know what it is the rating responsible for the maintenance of the aircraft carrier aircraft elevators, just the elevators that lift the aircraft.
That is another thing is because
– entire rating. I've never heard of it.
Yeah, exactly. We have this thing where you have you'll have a gunner's mate. You're like, okay, gunner's mate, got it, ordnance, sure. Guns. And then you'll have aviation ordnance men. And you're like, but it makes sense because, you know, a 76-millimeter cannon is not really comparable to a guided bomb off of an F-18.
Not
so.
At all.
It's a huge milieu of different rates, but you have to give it to them. You're like, I really don't want to make you guys too much of a generalist because you're handling a lot of explosives.
Very true.
Do you notice that we talked last week about James Bridger and I about West Africa? We had our African Navies Week. And the big thing was the Gulf of Guinea. Do you see that your program is starting to shift more its attention to those West African countries, to Cameroon, Nigeria, Ghana, and the rest of them to try to build that capacity as piracy raises its ugly head in West Africa, or has that remained mostly regional because ECOWAS still exists? Unlike Somalia, you still have Nigeria, which, although it has its own problems, is a pretty has some pretty potent military capabilities. What do you see? Do you see a shift in winds in West Africa, or what are your observations?
Yeah, no, good question. It's interesting. My entire time working with mobile training, the direction that we have been given is to expect to spend more of our time in East Asia, Southeast Asia, with this supposed Pacific pivot of where our military and international interests lie. And I feel like, despite that, over the course of the last 2 years, we're consistently being pulled back to Africa. And particularly with our mission demand, that demand signal is really beginning to come almost, I would say, exclusively from Southeast Asia, Africa. I just came from Tanzania, but particularly West Africa, and then some in the Caribbean, not so much in South America anymore. But absolutely, in the last year and a half, we've had teams go to Nigeria, Togo, Benin. We've had some, not necessarily in West Africa specifically, but some in Central Africa with a lot of riverine needs, capacity that needs attention. But from what I understand from this upcoming schedule, we have a couple on there. Gabon, we spent a lot of time in Sao Tome and Principe, Namibia. And I know that's starting to get pretty far south, but we do spend a lot of time working on the navies right there. So.
You know, I'm gonna go off the track here, but you know somebody who's done a lot of riverine stuff in Central African Republic and, with the Coast Guard?
Interestingly enough, we do have a mission on the block for the Central African Republic for this next year, but,
hasn't kicked off yet?
Not yet.
Okay, I was about to say that was the one regret I had for African Navies Week. It was West Africa, East Africa, nothing to the lake regions and riverine, so I was gonna berate, or not berate, but let's say try to convince you to start introducing some of these guys to me to maybe start writing for SimSec.
Sure.
Without naming a country, what is the craziest, most irresponsible thing that you've seen? Like, you walked into a room and you went, oh my god, what is happening in this place?
The most crazy, irresponsible thing I've
just
seen.
You walked in there and says, this is exactly why I'm in this place.
Well, there's a few. I've probably gotten numb to it at this point when I see.
That's not good.
No, I know.
That's a bad indicator.
Well, it is. Well, you know, safety is always our number one priority, and so we always will go certain places.
Don't say that. Oh, it's such an irritating.
Okay, I will tell you. This is the craziest thing that I've seen, and I don't want to name the country, so I'll leave that off the books. But I did travel to a certain country in my current tenure, where there was a very large donation program from the U.S. Embassy, and they'd been donated a very nice boat from Safe Boat USA. They were the manufacturer donated by the U.S. Embassy, and it was an absolutely gorgeous boat, and it would sit right in the middle of the harbor. And we were very impressed because they maintained a full-time watch on this boat, and they would take RHIs and paddle them out to the boat to change the watch because they didn't want to burn the gas by actually motoring them out there, and they would keep a 24-hour watch at all times of the day. And we were very impressed, and we kept asking questions like, they maintain a full watch on those boats? We've never seen that happen before, because it was right in the middle of the harbor, so we assumed it was for some sort of sentry duty. We ended up asking more questions, and they kind of fed off of our excitement about this. Well, when we finally got a chance to talk to the security cooperation officer who was on a visit, actually meeting with the AFRICOM commander at the time, who was General Carter Hamm, we were filled in that the reason why they maintained a full-time watch on this boat was not for any sort of security purpose. It's that another nearby nation had come to this country, ostensibly providing some sort of assistance. They had built part of a new pier for them and went to another recently donated boat and simply stole it. Another African nation took the boat and drove it back to their own country. And so the reason that they were keeping a full-time watch on this brand new
is
to make sure that it wouldn't get stolen. That was kind of crazy to me.
How do you even wow, that's like GTA Coast Guard. I don't even know where to begin.
I'll give another interesting one. I was teaching an engineering course, an outboard motor maintenance course, in another country, and one of the people that was in our class was the chief engineer for this organization. We thought, well, this is the perfect audience. We have the chief engineer in the entire country. And so as we started progressing through this course and performing a lot of the different functions, one of the members of the class asked the chief engineer, why don't you ever do any of these things? And his response in his own native Portuguese was siempre bom, siempre bom, which simply means he doesn't have to because it's always good. Which clearly was not the case. The chief engineer.
Oh, wow. There you go. That's why security assistance exists. Now, best thing that you've seen. So we've gone through the stories. And if another one comes to mind that is just as horrifying as someone stealing ships, please also bring that up. But all right, so we've concentrated. We've gotten into some of the bad. We've talked about lacks of resources. We've talked about the need for training. We've talked about guys just straight up stealing ships and not doing that. That blows my mind how that wouldn't become a diplomatic incident,
if the country just doesn't have enough pull in the community to make it matter. I mean, if you're the small child who pounds on the table, it doesn't mean that, you know, you're going to get what you want.
At the very least, that sounds like something that would end up on Drudge Report because it's weird. Nations steals other nations' warship. Just does it. But something that you've seen that really impressed you, that you said, okay, they're doing this right, or something that you learned when you went out and you did security assistance training where you said, you know, I might consider that. That's a pretty good idea.
Yeah, well, you know, we always learn something from the organizations and the people that we work with. There's always takeaways, whether that means that I'm able to come back and implement that in my day-to-day or in the Coast Guards is an entirely other story, but we always learn something. I'd say the biggest thing that I've seen is that sailors of every brand and variety across the world, regardless of what continent they're on or what country they're from or their religion or their background, there's two constants, and that is, number one, they really do take care of each other, and number two, they give each other hell for the smallest things. No matter what you do, and it's just like Coast Guard culture, I imagine it's similar in Navy culture, no matter what, just the smallest misstep, answering a question incorrectly, doing one step wrong, and you've got, you know, a pile of guys on you to remind you how you messed up. But I've certainly been impressed by a lot of the drive of a lot of the people that we've had a chance to interact with. You know, a lot of these places you go to, we might be the only Americans that they've ever interacted with in their entire lives. And, you know, most of the world has, surprisingly, what a lot of people don't realize is a very positive impression of Americans. And they also have some, I wouldn't say not so positive, but perhaps they have some illusions about Americans that we're all excruciatingly wealthy. And, you know, I often get questions like, you know, can you help me out? Can you get me a laptop computer? Or, you know, these questions where they just assume that I, you know, can pull a laptop computer out of a tree because I'm an American and give them away to the masses. But they have a generally very positive impression of Americans, and they're very happy to be able to be in a course where they're being taught by, you know, the people that they have been raised in their organizations and in their lives to believe are the best at this stuff. But there's certainly a lot of good positive takeaways. A lot of times where, and I'll give you one real positive example. I was recently in the Dominican Republic, and we were teaching contingency planning. I had done two back-to-back courses there, totaling about a month, and we were teaching them the incident command system, how to work within the interagency for various response organizations, disaster response, law enforcement response, on how to work together to tackle a major incident. And I found out shortly after we had left that there was an air show accident. There was an air show in Santo Domingo one of the aircraft crashed and they activated this system. And I remember the embassy sent us pictures of them activating their, you know, their command center and all of their displays. And they were name tagging all of their official positions within their ICS construct. And they were saying that this was going to be a very big reason why the Coast Guard was going to be coming back in the next year, was because this program had just been very, very successful in just a very short period of time. And so it's good to see, you know, those success stories.
Awesome. Now, to close this out, sort of get us towards the end here, because I know you got stuff to do. I don't want to monopolize your time. Is the what you think that we do or that your organization does that you see is the most valuable when you're on the ground? You say this is something that gets – when you say real capacity building, not shaking hands, not making friends, but this is no shit, a really positive piece of training that they take away and they can and they use and will use. And the second part, what is your favorite part of the job? And if you want to say driving around foreign towns, finding good pubs, you know, that's 100% acceptable answer.
In my experiences, we do have some success, and unfortunately, and this is just a product of the system. As a mobile training team, we're responsible purely for the training. We're not responsible for end user monitoring, product monitoring. So we don't do a lot of follow up unless the security cooperation officer or whoever is controlling the pot of money, whether that's the, you know, the diplomatic security special agent who does security for the country, another member of DOS, they're the ones who are responsible for deciding what the training requirements are and what their training goals are in support of broader national security objectives. So a lot of times when I go someplace, I might not have an opportunity to return to see exactly how those students are doing or if they're using or proliferating those skills, which is our intention, which is unfortunate, but it's the nature of the system that it's those positions who are doing that particular work. There are certainly places where we've gone to, and if it hasn't been me or another team that has returned, we have had other teams return and be able to follow up with the same students, even if it's a different course content area. And a big one, I would say, is Mexico. And I think that that's for a variety of reasons. That's not just entirely our teams and our roles in being the experts, but in their own training systems, like their availability of resources, their central follow-ups. I mean, when we were in Mexico, we work directly for the embassy for training, but you know, we're falling under the command structure of their actual schoolhouse, and they have their own quality control, follow-ups, demonstration of skills. You know, they don't want to bring a team there and waste it because, you know, the students are somehow hampered from training, whether it's cultural or whether it's their time or, you know, what it might be, their own motivation. You know, we do capacity building, and we do have success in achieving our goals. But unfortunately, I'm just not able to a lot of the times do a lot of on the ground follow up. So does that answer that first part of your question? Or did you want something more concrete?
I was looking. That's a good answer. But I was looking more for the piece of that training that you do. So if you go in, you do, hey, I'm going to train you how to do boardings. I'm going to train you how to do to repair outboard motors, A, B, C, D, and E, F, G. Which one of those would you say the trainings that you do is most valuable to those students by observation? So you're looking at them and you say, I see them grabbing this skill. I think they need this skill, and I think that's the one. I mean, I understand where you're going with it, where you're saying it's a little harder to determine which one of these is the most valuable. Most gut instinct, you say, I'm doing something that's right for these guys. They really need this.
Sure. I think all of our offerings, all of the skills that we're trying to transfer are valuable. Mm-hmm. I would say that in my experience, doing the engineering courses has probably been the one where I see the most benefit. And a reason for that is because if I go and I do a boarding officer course, I can get a really, really good product. I can take 24 guys in a class, and in like a 2 to 4 week period, I can have them ready to instruct this material within their own organization. The problem is that oftentimes if the organization is not tasked with doing a high volume of boardings or they don't have the equipment to do it, they won't have a chance to really use that skill. Same thing with operating boats. We try to teach them the basics on how to operate a boat all the way down to, you know, maintenance checks, risk analysis, how to operate in different conditions, how to do some advanced maneuvers. But again, they just don't get a whole lot of training opportunity because of the lack of resources in most circumstances. And this is in every country, but, you know, like, again, where we focus. But when it comes to engine maintenance, through their own processes of scavenging and having some understanding of the kind of parts and equipment and lubricants and whatever you may need, I feel like that there's a substantial interest in it. And when these folks will go back to their home units, if they have a problem, they take the time to actually see if it's something that might be a very simple fix. If it's replacing a spark plug or, you know, I don't want to get technical, but doing something very, very simple that, you know, you could do, change the oil in your own boat engines. That's something that they would otherwise have not been able to do, and it would have cost either them a lot of money or mm-hmm. the United States a lot of money in providing the repairs for that donated equipment. And to a lesser extent, just giving them a better foundation of understanding engineering not only helps them within their organizations, but to the same extent, sometimes in their personal lives, you know, when it comes to the repair and the maintenance of their own vehicles, motorcycles. Like, this is something that they genuinely take an interest in, and mm-hmm. I think they take back and we get a lot of success with. So
that's heartbreaking to a guy that I'm definitely not the engineering guy. I'm like, oh, let's talk about technology and let's talk about tactics, and then I was like, oh, engineering. But like, no thanks.
It's like I said, they're all valuable, but I feel like that's the one.
But you're 100% right. Like you said at the beginning, you can't really, to paraphrase, you can't really do maritime operations without maritime equipment. It's not like land forces where, you know, your feet aren't going to break down, but your boat will. And once your boat breaks down, you're kind of out of luck. And you're absolutely right. The engineering component is incredibly important if you don't have that backfill capability. Your favorite part of the job. So the thing that you train people or that you do or that you experience, that's your favorite part about being part of these mobile training teams.
Well, being able to do security assistance the way that I do is actually an incredible job. A lot of people tell me that I might have topped out in my career too soon, because it's going to be hard to going back to something in operations after having done this. For me, my favorite part and one of my roles, since I'm an officer and a team leader, is that I wouldn't say that my primary function is to instruct in a certain area. If I'm going to teach an outboard motor course, I'm going to take subject matter experts, mechanics, rated mechanics to do most of that training. So while I do participate in the training and I make sure that I'm an expert in those particular areas, really my primary mission as a team leader is the safety of the team, to do liaison with the embassy and the various agency representatives that we're working with, and also to be that focal point for the building of relationships and also trying to move those relationships forward by recommending them for future courses, recommending the country for future courses. And another component that really doesn't get talked about is a lot of the embassies and their various people who are responsible for security cooperation may have never interacted with the Coast Guard before. I mean, mm-hmm. most Americans wouldn't expect that the Coast Guard is overseas doing this kind of training on behalf of, security assistance objectives. So I really like the relationships, being able to see students develop, being able to leave them with a positive impression of us as a team, us as people, us as Americans. I always say when I'm graduating students that while we always arrive as, you know, students and instructors, we always leave as friends. And I think that's been the most incredible part. Though, as an aside, it's the benefits of being able to travel to little known areas and go exploring and, you know, search for the best bars and restaurants in town isn't exactly, a bad perk of the job either.
Favorite food? Where have you gone? Best food?
Oh, man. I'd say my favorite food by far, Malaysia. I'm a huge fan of Southeast Asia. They have like just some fantastic noodle dishes down there. I like the food in Indonesia as well. Maybe a little bit spicy for my taste. But that's the best food. Worst food, unfortunately, Africa. Some African dishes aren't bad, and I'll give you a point, but it's just kind of bland and a little bit tasteless, but it's filling.
You know what? Some along those lines, and I don't know if it's systemic, but, have you been to Atlanta?
I've flown to the airport many times, but I've never
stopped there. Okay. They've got the Coca-Cola Museum there. And here's the problem. It's got every continent. So you go to North America, you're like, no, I'm not going to drink any of this. I've already had this. Europe, okay, not that different. South America, okay, great. You've got lots of Fanta. Everyone loves Fanta. You go to Asia, okay, there's some weird stuff, but there's some good stuff. I don't know what's going on at that Africa Coca-Cola station, but it is some of the worst stuff that I've ever had. It's like, they're like, ooh, beetroot soda or something, and I'm like, you sell Coca-Cola to these guys, wouldn't they rather have that? I don't know what this is. Like, I don't know where this comes from or why it's here at this museum. You're not really doing yourself any favors with these flavors, but hey, you know.
Well, Coca-Cola's cornered the market on Africa. There's not a store or a restaurant or a wall that's not covered in Coca-Cola signs.
Have you encountered those drinks before? Like, especially the one that they had for Tanzania was really gross. And the weirdest thing is when I went there, I didn't see it anywhere. So maybe they're just trying to weird me out.
Yeah, maybe. I didn't experience any local branded colas like that. I didn't experience anything like that.
All right. Well, do you have anything? Do you have a Twitter handle? Anything that you want to plug at the end of the podcast?
I'll withhold any pluggings. No,
any pluggings? You know, I'm not even the Coast Guard.
Yeah, I mean, I could do that, but I feel like I spent a lot of time plugging the Coast Guard.
That's true. You know what you did? That sounds really – your job sounds so incredibly awesome. I'm not going to lie to you. That's impressive stuff. It's a
fun job.
You're on the front lines of American Hearts and Minds program, so that's awesome.
Well, I hate to plug the Coast Guard at the expense of the Navy, but I will say that the Navy has a very similar program to us. It's about four times as large, and it's actually stationed right down in Norfolk. But as a result of budget cuts, they are dismantling that unit this year. So your opportunity to go do full-time security assistance might have passed.
Oh, well.
Ad hoc.
Yeah, exactly. I'll just, you know, I'll get a plane ticket. I'll go over there and show up. Hey, guys, you want some security assistance? Who are you? Don't worry about it. All right. You can find us at Simsec, C-I-M-S-E-C, on Twitter. You can find us at www.simsec.org. And you can email me at nextwar, that's N-E-X-T-W-A-R, at simsec.org. And, of course, myself, Twitter, at America Hipple. And that is America in front of my name. And it has been a pleasure, Jim. This has been great.
Thanks, Matt.